It's time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us on a Friday morning live here on Robinhood Radio. We rebroadcast it on Monday following our noontime news. Also, we rebroadcast David on the weekend as well. And it's time to welcome him in again this morning from the media capital of the world, New York City. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Good to be with you again from the media capital of the world, New York City. Also, epicenter still, I'm afraid, of coronavirus in this country. As I said last week, and it's true this week, no one else has overtaken us yet.
Yep. Time will tell. I wouldn't want to, you know, this is strange, but folks, I'm not going to start off with the coronavirus. There's another.
Oh, good.
There's another story that's brewing. That's a big story. And, I just remember years ago when Hong Kong was handed over to China, one country, two systems, or however they described it. Hong Kong was going to be independent for X amount of years from China.
Autonomous, certainly, to some degree.
And
but
you're
right, one nation, two systems. And look at it now. You're about to tell me about a concern over yet more efforts by the Central Communist Party to pull Hong Kong fully into the mainland communist system. Is that your concern?
Yeah, because I was golfing at the Hotchkiss Golf Course many years ago when this was about to happen, and a very nice woman, a Chinese woman, was there, and her son was at Hotchkiss School. So we were golfing because you get paired up when you go as a single golfer. As we're golfing, I asked her about the upcoming Hong Kong, what was going to happen with China, because she was a very successful businesswoman in the fashion industry in Hong Kong. And she said back then, well, nothing's going to happen for probably 10, 15 years because China needs Hong Kong. China needs the cash. And they're going to bilk everything they can. And she told me that there was a certain date in the future that it wasn't going to be two systems. But that was long off. Well, I think it's meant to be, I think, 2027, but now China has moved to change security laws in Hong Kong, which would basically, for all intents and purposes, end it being Hong Kong being anywhere near being autonomous.
Yeah, that's true. And it's a huge story, of course. China getting its way yet again. I mean, it's a feature of all the developments regarding Hong Kong. In the long run, mainland China will win out. I mean, it's a kind of a given. It's a sort of wearily not voiced, but generally sort of sub voce, sort of slightly under the table, accepted by all participants and all close observers, that China, of course, will get its hands fully and entirely back on all the levers of power and commerce in Hong Kong. And this halfway house they've been enjoying since the late 90s is bound to end. And that was always the plan. It's now just a question of how quickly does that happen and how much can people who support democracy in Hong Kong slow the process down and keep a hold of their cherished democratic values. I suspect the slide is going to just keep on getting faster and faster in China's to China's benefit, but we'll see. I mean, we saw last year extraordinary steps taken by the population as a whole. China had never seen in any of its provinces anything like the massive protests in the streets and continuing. You know, the capacity of the protesters to just keep coming back throughout last year was remarkable. I mean, of course, they've been battered down, in a sense, now. And China believes in setting these new, or making these new claims, these new efforts to put you know, full central Communist Party control over Hong Kong. It's a new effort to just push it along the slide that we know is going to happen anyway. But the determination on both sides it makes for worrisome tension yet again, and it's something to, you know, for the world to keep a very close eye on.
I'm sorry I have to say this, but I would be figure most people out there in our country and a lot of people in other sections of the world forget Tiananmen Square, what a big deal and what a big protest that was. And it finally got to a point where China just shut that down abruptly. So I think by most people not revisiting that history and knowing what happened there and other things, just live in this fantasy world that Hong Kong is going to have a certain amount of freedom. It's not. That's just not the way the Chinese do things. It's just not.
The testing point, or at least the litmus test, if you like, will be what happens to all the Chinese troops, which are in barracks and could very easily just sort of flood the streets of Hong Kong if China decided that was what they wanted to do in a kind of repeat of Tiananmen Square. We need to, you know, keep a careful eye, as I say, and I suspect deployment of troops will be the absolute testing point.
And China now has become a major player in the world economy, along with the United States and the EU. But China's role in the world economy is so significant that who's going to line up against China? And something that's going to happen anyway in the future, whether it happens now or whether it happens 5 years from now?
Well, the question is, will anyone? The answer is anyone who cares enough to stand against an economic juggernaut, one whose process, by the way, is slowing. I mean, China actually had negative growth in its economic progress even before the coronavirus epidemic, which brought it to it, not exactly to its knees, but certainly inflicted an incredible blow. So much so that China is in negative growth situation, in a negative growth situation for the first time in 33 years. That's an extraordinary setback for them. But of course, they are still the number two economy in the world, next to the United States, and it takes courage to stand up to them, especially since they are such a huge trading nation now. Although, you know, one of their policies is to change the balance of their trade. They are determined now to develop a domestic market much more than relying entirely upon, or not entirely, but almost entirely on exports. So the rest of the world is going to suffer from China's own retraction. So everyone's on a kind of nervous knife edge when it comes to China, and coronavirus has just compounded that even more. If we're going to play stupid childish tactics with them, as a certain administration I can name is trying to do by turning coronavirus into an opportunity to say yaboo and be constantly sniping at China in international forums, I don't think that's going to get us anywhere. But a lot of very straight talking has to take place from positions of steadiness and conviction about what people want China to do and what they're able to sacrifice themselves in order to put pressure on China, if that's what they want to do. It'll be interesting to see how the rest of the world does treat China on the matter of Hong Kong and in the matter of the world economy, too.
And what's interesting about that, before I get into my next story with you and ask you about that, is that, and this is why the position that the United States, which is going to withdraw from another arms treaty, withdrew from the treaty on the environment, and basically which cast aspersions on NATO, the United States and the European Union in general need to be strong partners, because if they're strong partners together and work hand in hand together. That is a way to look back at China and combat China, but that's just not possible now because that's not the way the U.S. is viewed on the world stage anymore.
Well, the United States has abandoned its position of primacy, essentially by taking up the isolationist steady and deliberate move in that direction from the Trump administration. So we're in a position of being internally split in the West, as we can still call ourselves, I guess, the United States and Europe. You're right. It hardly represents any kind of helpful united front against China, if that's what we want to adopt. If we want to counter China, at least we'd be better off doing it. All common sense dictates as a united front rather than as people who squabble amongst themselves.
Now, I want to move back to this country and a story, and it's something that I thought about weeks ago, and it's going to be the story where Ahmaud Arbery was shot dead, and it was videotaped and put out, and eventually the men were arrested and there's an investigation. But what I thought the minute I saw that video that was released to social media and then news picked up on it was, why aren't you charging this person who's shooting the video? Because don't tell me that that person was following them and videoing them purely by accident. Just
sure.
Don't tell me that.
Yep.
You know, and it's taken.
Well, there was a suspiciousness about that video from the beginning. But one point is noting here, especially in the media context, is that no arrests were made for such a long time, 2 months or so. Law enforcement there just havered and hemmed and hawed about what to do because of connections between the alleged the older of the two alleged murders already arrested. Connections between them and the prosecutor's office itself in that area, the only reason that the arrest got made in the end was that this video was posted, and that was the result of action by a local broadcasting station. The free press comes into its own sometimes, and mercifully so, because who knows how much longer that case would have lingered without the proper law enforcement actions being taken. And now, of course, law enforcement is doing, well, it appears, what appears to be the sensible thing, taking in all other people who might have been involved in that killing. And fairly obviously, the person who was able to shoot the video so close to the action, following it behind, in fact, was an automatic suspect. But again, it's not exactly been quick, has it?
No, and I want to go to a story that's, and I saw the movie that was made after this person's life, and an extraordinary life and an extraordinary person. A White House butler who was actually, before he was a butler, was just a cleaner. Jackie Kennedy made him a butler, and he stayed through the Kennedy administration, the Johnson administration, every administration up through Reagan. And as a matter of fact, when the Obamas became residents of the White House, they invited him in. He passed away the other day due to the coronavirus. But if you've never seen the movie, it really is a pretty amazing movie to see how he dealt with racism at an early age. And even though and how he became a butler, and it sounds strange, but a butler at the White House to the president is a significant position. And to hear of his death, and then to find out about coronavirus. Well, I mean, he was elderly anyway, but a significant story about almost, it chronicles the history of the White House for almost 40 years, his presence
there.
Yeah,
what the butler saw is an old adage in English letters and in the media. It's almost a cliche, but what the butler saw is, of course, always very important, and certainly the continuity he represented in his loyal service But coming out retrospectively in the end in that documentary as a very informed and illuminating commentary on administration after administration after administration. It's a remarkable piece of work, and it is sad to see him go now.
All right, so we'll go back to the coronavirus for just a moment here, as now all 50 states in the United States, in one form or another, are slowly easing back some states, and some states jumping into it wholly, as the death toll now has reached just under 96,000 people. In now the
moving steadily towards that number of 100,000, which the White House said was just not possible a few months ago, and was denying that those projections had any real reality to them. Well, now we're getting very close to it, aren't we?
Yeah, and we're getting very close to it in only a matter of 10 weeks. Just imagine this now: 100,000 people will be dead in 10 weeks. From this coronavirus, and it still has a long course to run. So these projections that came out initially of 120,000 to 140,000 right now appear to be pretty much accurate, but we'll have to see what happens with the openings of these states, and with more and more people congregating, and with more and more people seemingly to getting confident in not wearing or social distance, wearing masks and doing social distancing. I mean, and then the cherry on the cake was yesterday on top of the ice cream sundae, was that if another outbreak does come, a large outbreak, that the federal government will not get involved in shutting down the country again.
Absolutely. Another edict from our chief commander-in-chief, yes, who also, in a media footnote, of course, went to a Ford factory that has been repurposed to making medical ventilators, and was urged, as indeed every single other individual was urged and who obeyed the urging to wear a mask. The president, of course, did not. He claims and indeed the Ford Motor Company does confirm that he wore a mask in certain parts of the factory when he was away from the cameras. But in his phrase, he didn't want to give the press the pleasure of seeing him and photographing him wearing a mask. That kind of reckless leadership, feckless, I would say it is actually, in its narcissistic self-involvement, is I'm afraid all too typical of the way that this administration at the very top has been handling the coronavirus pandemic and its effect on our country. But the patchiness of its what you're describing, the beginnings of easing up, prompts me to think, as Jill was telling me just a day or so ago, that it is striking how remarkably consistent all our press coverage is and has been from the very beginning. You look at this story, and it's one of just not being prepared, and a desperate effort. Well, I'm not sure the desperate effort is quite the right word. Confused and not very organized at all effort to catch up and deal, and then all sorts of ways in which we're falling short of what is needed, and I would say that that's been the story worldwide too. As I do reviewing the international media, it's remarkable to see from Zimbabwe to even Albania, I noticed the alphabet in reverse, Z to A, countries are just telling the same story about themselves. I mean, the honest press in those countries is telling the same story, and so you know, it prompts me to say that, you know, in a sort of almost a world-weary way, this is how it is. This is what a pandemic is actually like, and we've had some instances in world history before, so we needn't be surprised. But the panicky hysterical way that it is being reported now, in the serious outlets as well as the tabloids, is a matter of great distress to me. And I think we need to take a moment just to catch our breath and pause and maybe think about this a bit. And I'm glad to say that there are some media outlets that are doing that. And as I survey all the misinformation as well as the information, which compounds the sense of hysteria, I think the fact that we've got all the lunacy spreading through mainstream media as well as social media requires us to be very judicious about what we take in and how much we get influenced by this extraordinary wave of journalistic, I'm not going to say irresponsibility, because it springs from a sense of responsibility, but the overall sort of surge of it is I think when you see it compounded together, is on the side of panic rather than on the side of straightforward dealing. I ought to be making a regular habit of doing something that I really think is important for a media observer like myself to do, which is to find. It was an old phrase of Alex Haley, who wrote Roots, who said, "Find the good and praise it." And I want to point out that there are places that we can go to, and we can see good, sober reporting and good, sober analysis without the hysteria that seems to wash through so much of the media. And I want to single out today the Atlantic magazine. It's been extraordinary, and it's very steady and informative and objective and careful. Analysis and presentation of often very complicated ideas, but in very understandable ways. And it's largely the responsibility of a particular journalist at the Atlantic, their science writer, Ed Yong. I don't want to display any untoward bias, but he happens to be British, but that's sort of irrelevant. But he's also, just as a matter of personal information about him, he happens to be a huge fan, has been ever since he was 7 years old, I think, of David Attenborough. So he's that kind of science writer. He knows about how to popularize things or make things clear to the popular imagination. And the Atlantic has been distinguished by remarkable coverage, a large amount of it from Ed Yong. Just every couple of days, it's not as if it's a continually rolling machine that just churns out stuff like many of the bigger organizations. These are studiedly careful pieces written when they're finished, not rushed, but just placed in the magazine's pages and on the screen. You know, every few days, that just set things in context. That wonderful, soothing and calming word that it's important to hear all the time. What is the context for what we've just heard? What is the importance of a new development that we've suddenly had reported to us? So all the way back to January, when at that time Ed Yong was calling it the 2019 nCoV virus. It hadn't gotten the name that we now know it by quite then, but that's obviously it's a name that's derived from that code that it had at the beginning. They were reporting on it from the sparse details that were coming out of China, and by February he was talking about how the truly modern way, I mean, he called it a modern pandemic. I mean, at that time it was an epidemic, not a pandemic, but it was very modern in the way that it was getting transmitted, and that made it a truly global disease, and it would make it in its effect upon us truly global. And of course he was right, and the articles kept coming and they're still coming. Wonderful anatomizing of the debacle of the United Kingdom's herd immunity notion from Boris Johnson. Very clear piece of writing, and just yesterday making it clear to us how uncoordinated, the point you were making, how uncoordinated and inconsistent the complete patchwork quilt that the United States is, all its states and territories, when it comes to handling the pandemic, the with states and localities all going their own way. There's a word of commendation for the Atlantic magazine, and a suggestion for listeners too. If they want to just take a breath and get some sense of overall understanding rather than just reactivity to individual pieces of news, I would say that at the moment the Atlantic is the place to go.
Well, on that note, we will wrap things up for today. A positive note on where real news can be found. And I say real news, not saying that fake news is not what I'm talking about, but real, objective, honest reporting can be found.
In the round, yes, yeah. Absolutely.
David, we'll speak to you next week.
Look forward to that.
Take care.
Bye now.
That is the Media Beat with David Terachuk. And, of course, if you miss it here on air live, it's online, robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Terachuk. You can find David as a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief and his own website, themediabeat.us, as well.